A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been dealing with bile reflux gastritis for 7 years since his gallbladder surgery, and it's not getting better, but also not getting worse. He's waiting months to see a specialist about UDCA, but in the meantime, he wants practical things he can do. Specifically, dietary changes or over-the-counter supplements to either reduce the bile reflux in the first place or make it less damaging when it does happen. He mentioned even moderate alcohol and vigorous exercise both trigger flares, and he's already looking at zinc carnosine for mucosal repair. He doesn't want a laundry list of supplements, just targeted things worth trying while he waits for that specialist appointment.
This is one of those situations where the gap between what the literature supports and what patients can actually access is just maddening. The prompt mentions UDCA, ursodeoxycholic acid. And that's genuinely one of the best-studied interventions for bile reflux gastritis. It works by shifting the bile acid pool from predominantly hydrophobic, detergent-like bile acids to more hydrophilic, less toxic ones. Basically, it makes your bile less corrosive to the stomach lining.
It's not stopping the reflux. It's making the reflux less weaponized.
It's the chemical equivalent of swapping out industrial degreaser for hand soap. But getting it prescribed is the bottleneck, and in the meantime, there are useful things to do. Let me start with the dietary side because that's where the biggest wins are, and the mechanism the prompt describes is actually really important for understanding why diet matters. When the stomach gets physically jostled, vigorous exercise, or when the lower esophageal sphincter relaxes from alcohol, bile that's pooled in the duodenum gets pushed retrograde into the stomach. It's a mechanical problem exacerbated by chemical factors.
Like a bottle getting squeezed, which is actually the image Daniel used.
And once bile is in the stomach, it does two things. One, it directly damages the gastric mucosa because bile acids are detergents. They solubilize cell membranes. Two, it creates an alkaline environment in the stomach that paradoxically triggers more gastrin release, which then stimulates more acid production. And now you've got bile plus acid collaborating on mucosal destruction. It's a nasty 1-2 punch.
The stomach is getting attacked by both its own acid and someone else's bile. That's the gastrointestinal equivalent of getting jumped by two different gangs at once.
That's not even an exaggeration. So let's talk about what actually works. The single most evidence-backed dietary intervention is reducing dietary fat, particularly at individual meals. Here's why. Fat is the primary trigger for cholecystokinin release, and CCK is what makes the gallbladder contract. Except there's no gallbladder anymore, so instead of a coordinated squirt of bile into the duodenum, you get this continuous slow trickle of bile from the liver. But a high-fat meal still triggers a big CCK surge, which now just increases hepatic bile output and duodenal motility in ways that promote reflux into the stomach.
Low-fat meals mean less bile production to reflux in the first place.
And we're not talking zero fat, that's neither healthy nor practical. But keeping meals below about 15 to 20 grams of fat seems to be the threshold where symptoms meaningfully drop. There was a study out of Japan where they've actually studied this extensively because bile reflux is more commonly diagnosed there post-gastrectomy that showed patients on a low-fat diet had significantly lower bile acid concentrations in gastric aspirates compared to controls.
Japan's endoscopy culture is completely different. They scope everybody, they find things, they study things. The West barely notices.
So low-fat meals, that's intervention number one. Number two is meal timing and volume. Large meals distend the stomach, which mechanically increases the chance of duodenogastric reflux. Smaller, more frequent meals reduce that distension pressure. And critically, not lying down within 2 to 3 hours after eating. Gravity is your friend here. It keeps gastric contents where they belong.
Which is obvious advice, but also the kind of thing people ignore because it sounds too simple to work.
Yet it's probably the single highest impact behavioral change. Now, the alcohol piece. The prompt mentions even moderate alcohol causes flares, and the mechanism is multifactorial. Alcohol directly relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter. It increases gastric acid secretion, and it impairs gastric emptying. But here's what's interesting. Different types of alcohol have different effects. Beer and wine are particularly bad for reflux in general because they're acidic on top of the alcohol effect. Clear spirits in moderation tend to be less provocative, though for someone with established bile reflux gastritis, the safest bet is probably just avoiding alcohol entirely until the mucosa has had time to heal.
The whiskey sour is out. What about the exercise piece? That one's trickier because telling someone not to exercise is bad advice for every other system in their body.
It's a real tension. The mechanism is straightforward. Running, jumping, any kind of high impact or vigorous core engaging movement literally jostles the stomach and duodenum. And if the pylorus is even slightly incompetent, which it often is after cholecystectomy because the normal neurohormonal coordination is disrupted, bile gets pushed up. But you're right, the answer can't be don't exercise. The answer is probably switching to lower impact forms during flare periods. Swimming, walking, cycling on an upright bike rather than a recumbent one where you're leaned back. And crucially, timing exercise so you're not doing it on a full stomach.
What about resistance training? Because that's where people really brace their core.
Heavy lifting, especially anything that increases intra-abdominal pressure. Deadlifts, squats, overhead press, those are going to be the most problematic. Doesn't mean you can never do them, but during an active flare, they're like asking for trouble. Better to shift to higher reps with lower weight and focus on breathing in a way that doesn't create that Valsalva pressure spike.
We've got low-fat meals, smaller meals, don't lie down after eating, rethink the exercise timing and type, and probably put the beer down. That's the mechanical and chemical reduction side. What about making the bile less damaging once it's there?
This is where supplements come in, and I want to be really careful here because the prompt explicitly says I don't want to be one of those people that takes a laundry list of supplements. So let me give you the short list of things that actually have evidence, not the maybe this helps list you'd find on a wellness blog.
The supplement industry has turned bile reflux into a cottage industry of hope in a bottle.
The first and probably most important is something the prompt already mentioned, zinc carnosine. And I want to clarify how it works, because it's not just post-hoc damage repair. Zinc carnosine has a unique property. It adheres to the gastric mucosa and provides a protective coating while simultaneously promoting mucosal healing through multiple mechanisms. It stimulates heat shock proteins, it has antioxidant effects, and it specifically promotes the migration and proliferation of epithelial cells to repair damage. There was a systematic review in 2019 that looked at zinc carnosine for gastrointestinal mucosal protection and found it significantly improved symptoms and endoscopic findings in patients with gastric mucosal injury.
It's both a shield and a repair crew.
That's the best way to think about it. It's not just repairing damage after the fact. It's providing a physical barrier that makes the mucosa more resilient to bile acid exposure in the first place. Typical dosing is 75 mg of zinc carnosine twice daily, which provides about 34 mg of elemental zinc total. And the prompt mentioned iHerb ships to Israel, they carry the standard Pepzen GI formulation, which is the most studied one.
That's supplement number one. What's number two?
Sucralfate is technically a prescription medication in most countries, but in some places it's available over the counter, so I'll mention it briefly because it's worth asking about. It works by forming a protective gel-like coating over damaged mucosa and specifically binds bile acids. It's one of the few agents that directly addresses the bile component rather than just the acid.
It's not something you can just order from iHerb.
So for truly over-the-counter options, the second one with real evidence is Slippery Elm. The inner bark of Ulmus rubra contains mucilage that forms a protective demulcent coating over the mucosa. It's been used for centuries, and there's actually decent mechanistic evidence that it provides a physical barrier against irritants. It's not going to heal the underlying problem, but as a symptomatic intervention while waiting for definitive treatment, it's low risk and has a plausible mechanism.
The herbal tea of gastrointestinal despair. I say that affectionately. I practice leaf medicine myself.
Your leaf medicine credentials are well established and deeply questionable.
Deeply questionable is the name of my practice. What about the dosing on Slippery Elm?
Typically 1 to 2 teaspoons of the powder mixed in water, taken before meals and before bed. The timing matters because you want that coating in place before food or bile hits the stomach. Which brings up an important point about timing supplements in general. Zinc carnosine is best taken between meals because you want it to adhere to the mucosa without food competing for contact. Slippery elm before meals. They're complementary rather than redundant.
We've got zinc carnosine between meals, slippery elm before meals. That's a two-supplement regimen. But what about the actual bile binding? Because everything we've talked about is either reducing reflux or protecting the mucosa. Is there anything over-the-counter that actually binds bile acids in the stomach?
This is where the evidence gets thinner but not non-existent. Psyllium husk fiber has been shown to bind bile acids in the intestinal lumen. The question is whether it does anything meaningful in the stomach. The mechanism would be that soluble fiber creates a viscous gel that can trap bile acids and prevent them from contacting the mucosa. There's some evidence that high fiber diets reduce bile reflux symptoms, but it's mostly observational. The fiber angle is probably more about accelerating gastric emptying and reducing duodenogastric reflux pressure gradients than about direct bile binding in the stomach.
Fiber is good for the broader motility picture, but it's not a targeted bile binder.
Now there is one other over-the-counter option worth mentioning, and it's actually one of the simplest, calcium carbonate. Plain old calcium carbonate antacids. Calcium binds bile acids. It forms insoluble calcium soaps with them. This is actually why some of the older literature on bile reflux mentioned calcium supplementation. The problem is, you'd need to take it frequently, and high-dose calcium carbonate comes with its own issues, including acid rebound. But as a rescue intervention when symptoms are acute, chewing a couple of calcium carbonate tablets can provide some direct bile acid neutralization.
That's the most pedestrian intervention imaginable, and I love it. Chew some Tums, bind some bile.
Sometimes the unsexy answer is the right one, but let me put all of this into a coherent framework because I've thrown a lot of things at you. The approach while waiting for that specialist appointment should be three-pronged. Prong 1. Reduce the amount of bile refluxing. That's the low-fat meals, smaller meals, meal timing, gravity, alcohol avoidance, and exercise modification. Prong 2. Protect the mucosa so that whatever bile does reflux causes less damage. That's zinc carnosine between meals and slippery elm before meals. Prong 3. Have a rescue strategy for breakthrough symptoms, which is calcium carbonate as needed.
The nice thing about this framework is it doesn't require a doctor's prescription for any of it, and it's not a laundry list. It's two daily supplements, some dietary discipline, and a rescue antacid.
And I want to address something the prompt mentioned about things not getting better, but also not getting worse over 7 years. That's actually an important clinical observation because it suggests a stable chronic condition rather than a progressive one. The mucosa is being repeatedly injured, but it's also repeatedly healing, just never fully. That's actually a scenario where mucosal protective strategies can potentially shift the balance toward more complete healing.
There's a window of opportunity there.
Chronic bile reflux gastritis can lead to intestinal metaplasia over decades. That's where the stomach lining starts to change its cellular composition in response to chronic injury, and that's a precancerous condition. So the goal isn't just symptom control, it's preventing that long-term progression, which is why getting on UDCA eventually matters. It addresses the root chemical problem rather than just managing the consequences.
To be clear, UDCA is not some experimental fringe thing. This is a well-established bile acid that's been used for decades for primary biliary cholangitis and for gallstone dissolution. Using it for bile reflux gastritis is off-label but mechanistically sound and supported by a decent body of literature.
Yeah, the evidence base is stronger than many on-label uses of other drugs. There was a randomized controlled trial published in the Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology that showed UDCA significantly reduced gastric bile acid concentrations and improved symptoms in patients with bile reflux gastritis. The typical dose studied is 10 to 15 milligrams per kilogram per day, usually split into two doses. For a 70 kilogram person, that's about 1,000 milligrams a day.
Which is not a small dose, and it's not cheap, and that's part of why getting it prescribed is such a battle. Insurance doesn't want to cover it for off-label use.
Gastroenterologists who aren't familiar with the literature may not think of it. Bile reflux is underdiagnosed in general because the standard workup for reflux symptoms is an upper endoscopy looking for acid damage, and bile reflux can cause significant symptoms with completely normal acid exposure on pH monitoring. It's a blind spot in gastroenterology.
The motility blind spot.
But here's what I'd say about the specialist visit when it does happen. Go in prepared. Bring the literature. The 2019 Systematic Review on Bile Reflux Management specifically mentions UDCA as a therapeutic option. The Rome Foundation's Functional GI Disorder Guidelines acknowledge bile reflux as a distinct entity. Having those citations ready changes the conversation from, "I read something on the internet," to, "Here's the evidence."
There's an art to presenting evidence to a doctor without making them defensive.
The framing matters. I've been dealing with this for 7 years, I've been reading about UDCA, and I'd like to discuss whether it might be appropriate for my situation. Lands very differently from, "I want this drug and here's why you should give it to me."
The collaborative framing. So to summarize the actionable regimen while waiting. Low-fat meals, under 20 grams of fat per meal. Smaller, more frequent meals. No lying down for 3 hours after eating. Avoid alcohol entirely. Or at minimum stick to clear spirits in very small amounts and see how you respond. Switch to low-impact exercise, especially during flares, and don't exercise on a full stomach. Zinc carnosine, 75 milligrams twice daily between meals. Slippery elm, 1 to 2 teaspoons in water before meals and before bed. Calcium carbonate as needed for breakthrough symptoms.
That's the core protocol. I'd add one more dietary nuance that often gets overlooked. Certain foods are particularly good at buffering bile acids, and others are particularly provocative. On the protective side, pectin-rich foods, apples, carrots, the white pith of citrus fruits. Pectin is a soluble fiber that's particularly effective at binding bile acids. On the provocative side, anything that relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter, chocolate, peppermint, caffeine, and obviously alcohol. Peppermint is a weird one because people think of it as soothing for digestion, and it is for intestinal cramping, but it relaxes the LES and can make reflux worse.
Peppermint tea after dinner is the go-to digestive aid, and for bile reflux, it's basically opening the door and inviting trouble upstairs.
And spicy foods. Capsaicin directly irritates an already damaged gastric mucosa. It's not that spicy food causes the reflux, it's that it amplifies the damage from bile that's already there.
What about the timing of the zinc carnosine and slippery elm together? If someone's taking both, do they interfere with each other?
Slippery elm can potentially reduce absorption of other things because of that mucilage coating, so I'd separate them by at least an hour. Zinc carnosine mid-morning and mid-afternoon between meals, slippery elm 15 to 20 minutes before meals. That way, you're getting the mucosal protection from the slippery elm right before food arrives, and the zinc carnosine has its own window to adhere.
Neither of these is going to cause the kind of side effects that make people abandon their supplement regimen after 3 days.
Zinc carnosine is generally very well tolerated. The elemental zinc content is modest, about 34 milligrams total daily from the standard dose, so you're not going to get zinc toxicity. Some people get mild nausea if they take zinc on an empty stomach, but zinc carnosine is specifically designed to be gentle. Slippery elm is basically inert beyond its mucilage effects. The biggest risk with slippery elm is that it can theoretically delay absorption of other medications, so if someone's on something time-sensitive, they'd want to separate dosing.
This is a regimen that's unlikely to cause harm and has a reasonable chance of providing meaningful symptom relief while waiting for definitive treatment. That's about as good as it gets for a stopgap.
I think that's the right way to frame it. None of this is curative. UDCA or another bile acid sequestrant is the disease-modifying intervention. But 7 years is a long time to suffer while waiting for the right prescription, and there are things that can make those months more bearable.
The prompt also mentioned vigorous exercise specifically as a trigger, and I want to circle back to that because there's a nuance here that's worth spelling out. It's not just the mechanical jostling. Intense exercise also diverts blood flow away from the GI tract, which slows gastric emptying, which means whatever bile does reflux sits in the stomach longer. So you've got two mechanisms working against you. More reflux from the physical movement, and slower clearance from the reduced splanchnic blood flow.
That's a really important point, and it explains why even non-jarring intense exercise can still trigger symptoms. Something like spinning or an intense cycling session, you're not bouncing up and down, but you're still redirecting blood flow away from the gut. The combination of mechanical and vascular factors makes exercise a particularly potent trigger.
Which is depressing because exercise is supposed to be the thing that fixes everything.
The cruel irony of chronic illness. The things that help overall health can exacerbate specific conditions. But I'd rather someone modify their exercise than abandon it entirely. Walking is one of the best things for GI motility. It promotes gastric emptying and coordinated gut motility without the jarring or vascular steel of higher intensity exercise. A 20-minute walk after meals is probably the single most underrated intervention for reflux of any kind.
The postprandial constitutional. Our grandparents were right about everything.
They really were. And I'll add one more thing about the long-term picture. The prompt mentions things haven't gotten worse in 7 years. That's actually somewhat reassuring from a structural standpoint. It suggests there isn't a progressive anatomical problem like a worsening hiatal hernia or a progressively incompetent pylorus. It's a stable state, which means stabilizing interventions have a real chance of shifting the equilibrium.
The specialist visit, when it happens, should include a discussion of whether a repeat endoscopy is warranted, if there hasn't been one in a while. 7 years of chronic bowel reflux is long enough that you'd want to know if there's any intestinal metaplasia developing.
The Seattle Protocol for Barrett's Esophagus Surveillance has taught us that chronic mucosal injury demands periodic inspection. Bile reflux is a known risk factor for gastric intestinal metaplasia and even gastric cancer in the long term. It's not something to panic about, but it's something to monitor.
The specialist visit isn't just about getting UDCA. It's about getting a current assessment of what 7 years of this has done to the stomach lining.
And that actually brings me back to zinc carnosine in a way that closes the loop. One of the things zinc carnosine has been specifically studied for is preventing the progression of gastric mucosal injury to more serious pathology. There's some evidence from Japanese studies that it can actually reverse low-grade dysplasia, so using it while waiting for that endoscopy isn't just symptom management. It might actually be doing something protective at the tissue level.
That's a compelling reason to start it now rather than waiting for the specialist to weigh in.
I think so. The risk-benefit ratio is extremely favorable.
Let me ask you about one thing we haven't touched. The prompt mentions iHerb ships to Israel. For listeners who aren't in Israel, are there any regional availability issues with these supplements?
Zinc carnosine in the PepZen GI formulation is widely available internationally through iHerb, Amazon, and most online supplement retailers. The brand that's most studied is the one manufactured by Hamari Chemicals in Japan and licensed to various supplement companies. Slippery Elm is a bit more regional. It's widely available in North America, less so in Europe and the Middle East, but iHerb carries several brands that ship internationally. Calcium carbonate is obviously available everywhere.
The supply chain is not the bottleneck.
No. The bottleneck is the specialist appointment, and I want to emphasize something the prompt brought up about not wanting to be someone who takes a laundry list of supplements. That instinct is correct. The more supplements you add, the more potential interactions, the more cost, the lower compliance. Two targeted supplements with complementary mechanisms is a regimen people can actually stick with.
There's a dignity element to this, too. Chronic illness already makes you feel like your body is a project that requires constant management. Keeping the intervention list short preserves some sense of normalcy.
That's well said. The goal is to make life livable while waiting for definitive treatment, not to turn every meal into a pharmaceutical operation.
If someone's listening to this and they're in a similar situation, post-cholecystectomy bile reflux, waiting on a specialist, trying to function in the meantime, the message is, there are things you can do, they're not complicated, and they're grounded in real mechanisms rather than wishful thinking.
The evidence, while not perfect, is better than what backs a lot of things doctors prescribe without hesitation. The fact that UDCA is considered alternative for this indication, while PPIs are handed out like candy for bile reflux, which they don't even treat, tells you something about the gaps between evidence and practice.
Prescribing PPIs for bile reflux is like prescribing sunglasses for a hearing problem.
That's going to be the pull quote from this episode, but it's accurate. PPIs reduce acid, and bile reflux causes damage regardless of acid levels. In fact, making the stomach less acidic might actually make bile acids more damaging, because bile acids are more soluble and more toxic at higher pH.
Wait, say more about that. That's counterintuitive.
It's one of those physiological twists that matters enormously. Bile acids precipitate out of solution at low pH. In a highly acidic stomach, bile acids are less soluble and less damaging. When you raise the gastric pH with a PPI, you keep more bile acids in solution, and they're actually in their more membrane-damaging form. There's a reason the stomach is supposed to be acidic, and one of those reasons is that acid inactivates bile acids.
PPIs could theoretically make bile reflux worse.
Theoretically, and in some studies actually. There's literature showing that long-term PPI use is associated with more severe bile reflux damage in some patients. Not because PPIs cause reflux, but because they change the chemical environment in ways that make bile more toxic.
That's the kind of thing that should be much more widely known. Millions of people are on PPIs post-cholecystectomy because they have reflux, and nobody checked whether it's acid or bile.
The symptoms overlap significantly. Burning, epigastric pain, nausea. The distinguishing feature is often that bile reflux causes a bitter or bilious taste, and the pain is more constant rather than meal-related. But most patients never get a Biliteq probe or a gastric bile acid measurement. They just get a PPI prescription and a shrug when it doesn't work.
Part of what the specialist visit should accomplish is confirming that this is actually bile reflux, and not some other post-cholecystectomy syndrome.
The differential includes bile reflux, but also sphincter of Oddi dysfunction, functional dyspepsia, and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, all of which are more common after gallbladder removal. A good gastroenterologist will work through that differential rather than just throw in a PPI at the problem.
Which brings us back to the core question. While waiting for that good gastroenterologist, what can you do? And I think we've laid out a pretty clear answer.
Low-fat small meals, don't lie down after eating, modify exercise, consider eliminating alcohol at least temporarily, zinc carnosine between meals, slippery elm before meals, calcium carbonate as needed. It's a protocol that addresses the mechanical, the chemical, and the mucosal dimensions of the problem.
That's the framework. Reduce the reflux. Protect the mucosa. Manage breakthrough symptoms. Three prongs, two supplements, no laundry list.
I'll add one thing that costs nothing and has zero side effects. The gut-brain axis is real, and stress amplifies visceral hypersensitivity. Two people can have the same amount of bile in their stomach, and the one under chronic stress will feel it more intensely. I'm not saying meditate your way out of bile reflux, that's insulting. But recognizing that stress amplifies symptoms can help contextualize flares and reduce the secondary anxiety that makes everything worse.
The "am I making this worse by worrying about it?" spiral.
Breaking that spiral has real value, even if it doesn't change the underlying physiology.
To the prompt's hope question, is there reason for hope? I'd say yes on two fronts. One, the things you can do right now are not trivial. They're not placebo-level interventions. Two, UDCA is a real option with real evidence behind it, and going into that specialist appointment armed with the literature gives you a much better chance of actually getting it prescribed.
The third reason for hope is that 7 years of stable symptoms suggest this isn't a degenerative spiral. It's a chronic equilibrium that can potentially be shifted in a better direction with the right interventions.
That's a good place to land. Practical, evidence-grounded, neither overpromising nor nihilistic.
Which is basically our brand at this point.
The brand is, we read the papers so you don't have to, and we'll tell you which supplements are worth your money.
I'll take it. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, Bhutanese villagers near the Himalayan tree line began leaving offerings of fermented barley for a particular snow leopard that had inexplicably taken to curling up beside grazing yaks at night, rather than hunting them. The leopard, whom they named Karma, never attacked the livestock and was observed for 11 winters before disappearing. Local oral histories describe this as a pact of the high passes, though zoologists remain baffled by the behavioral anomaly.
I have so many questions.
None of which will be answered. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to dig deeper into anything we talked about, the show notes are at myweirdprompts.com. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Leave a review if you're so inclined. It helps other people find the show.
If you're waiting on a specialist appointment, hang in there. Sometimes the stopgap is better than nothing.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.